On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For 200 years, Jane Austen's novels have never been out of print. In fact, they're big sellers. And today, that's the least of it. There's something about Jane Austen, she of Pride and Prejudice, of Sense and Sensibility, that is irresistible to 21st century fans. On the page, on the screen, in the culture. Today, Becoming Jane, a fictionalized biopic of the never-married author, opens nationwide. Here, love interest James McAvoy addresses Anne Hathaway as Jane.
If you wish to practice the art of fiction, to be the equal of a masculine author, your horizons must be widened. By an extraordinary young man.
By a very dangerous young man.
This hour on Point, why Jane Austen's stories of mannered English romance from two centuries ago are such a hit today. Joining me today from Princeton, New Jersey, is Claudia Johnson, professor of English at Princeton University and an authority on Jane Austen. She's just finished her latest book titled Jane Austen's Cult and Cultures, which looks at the phenomenon of Jane Austen mania over the last two centuries. Claudia Johnson, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
And with us from New York is Jenny Davidson, English professor at Columbia University. Her lively seminar on Jane Austen is one of the most sought-after classes on campus. Jenny Davidson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So here we are. We're in the midst of a media whirl, a Hollywood whirl. There's been a Bollywood whirl around Jane Austen. And Claudia Johnson, you've looked at it over a long, long time. I mean, it's hot as it could possibly be right now, but it's not the first time. In a way, she never goes away. It's wave after wave.
That's really true. Ever since her death in 1817, she has been the object of great adoration. And, you know, the very year that she died, her grave was mentioned as a tourist site.
All the way in 1817, and the waves since then, I mean, I'm reading here of great popularity around World War I, of course, that she was back in the 40s. I mean, we don't slice it too narrowly here, but it's all the way back in the mid-90s now, more than a decade ago, that she got the really hot screen treatment started. Can you associate times when Jane Austen is hot and popular again with particular kinds of goings-on, Claudia?
Well, I think, the mania actually goes back to the 19th century, and it's true it might not have been as boisterous as it is now. At first, she was a beloved among connoisseurs, and it was later that she became part of a highly commercialized book and magazine industry. And now, of course, she's part of a multimillion-dollar film industry. So the world has never really forgotten her, although she is treated as though she has been rediscovered with each new wave.
Right. We'll hear in a few minutes about Becoming Jane, the movie that opens nationally today, this fictionalized biopic. Many people may take their biographical understanding of Jane Austen, at least the beginnings of it, from this book. But Jenny Davidson, for those who don't know us, just introduce Jane Austen to us for a second. Who are she? Where and when did she live and write? And how do you describe the nut of her literary offering?
What would I say? Well, for me, really, Jane Austen is all about the language, so I think that's part of what keeps on drawing us back to these books. Her life was relatively uneventful as these things go. She stayed fairly close to home. She moved a few times, and some of those moves were difficult. She was in a very warm and close family circle that mattered a lot to her. So she's not one of those writers who had a tumultuous, you know, well-documented, hugely eventful life, like, for instance, her contemporary Byron, who did much more obviously adventurous things. We've got some letters that Austen wrote to her dear sister Cassandra, for instance. But after Jane Austen died, her sister burned any letters that would seem to perhaps, you know, reveal secrets better not left for posterity. So, in fact, we don't have a huge amount of information outside of the books about the inner emotional life of Jane Austen. What we really have to go with, I think, are the novels.
A half dozen novels that got released kind of one after another or over a relatively short period. Claudia Johnson, I mean, you said, isn't it funny that this sort of remote, modest, retiring spinster has such an appeal yet again. Jenny says it's the language, but it's clearly also something about romance and even manners in a very unmannered time today.
Absolutely. I think Jennifer's absolutely right. But there's also a certain mystery around the figure of Jane Austen herself, that someone so ordinary looking could be so great and could be mistaken for an ordinary person. I think students are very responsive to the whole idea of manners. And even though our manners are different now, we still have protocols of behavior that require decoding. And I think when students encounter Jane Austen, they see that she's basically writing about a world they recognize, where there's a circle of friends who talk with and about each other and who observe each other's behavior and try to figure out what it all means.
On the other hand, New York Times points out, there was a rigid code of social rules, must have been repressive if you lived in it, but pretty it up on the screen and it can seem positively peaceful and stable, a respite from today's fraught, slippery world of quick hookups, divorce, and family counseling. There's a different world. Claudia, you've got a bit from one of her novels that you might read for us. We're going to go into the movie side of this, but take us straight into the original first, if you would. Give us a little reading and begin to unfold it for us, if you'd be good enough.
Well, I have a long passage, but I thought maybe I would start with a short passage. It's just a single sentence, and it comes from her novel Northanger Abbey. And it's when the heroine listens to her boyfriend and the boyfriend's sister talk about landscape theory, and she can't understand any of it. And she says, "I cannot speak well enough to be unintelligible." And that's taken.
Simple and straightforward than that.
Exactly, and that's taken to be a satire on jargon and technical language.
And maybe men.
And maybe men who wield that language, and yet there's also something really true about what she's saying, that the character is too transparent, and that her you know exactly what she feels and who she's in love with and what she thinks about things, and that transparency makes her very vulnerable. And what she has to learn throughout the course of the novel is to mask herself, to be mistakable. In other words, to practice manners. And I also think that statement, "I cannot speak well enough to be unintelligible," is also a statement about Jane Austen's writing, which is a lot more difficult than it seems.
Jenny, when you open the application time for your seminar at Columbia, you've got people beating down the doors, many times the number of applicants as those that can sit around the table. What do you see in those young, largely Americans, I guess, today? What is bringing them with such enthusiasm to Jane Austen and your course?
It is a fascinatingly different population, I think, than I get for most of my other courses, and certainly it's by far my most oversubscribed course. I do find that there's a tendency among the students who have especially strongly bonded with Jane Austen to really talk about the characters in the novels and their emotional lives almost as if they're real people.
So Elizabeth and Eleanor and Darcy and Emma and you name it, they're old pals.
That's right. They're on a first-name basis, for sure. So it's a very intense relationship that sometimes actually makes it difficult to have really productive conversations in the classroom, especially if you're trying to think in a technical way, how does Jane Austen, the writer, pull off this kind of effect in this paragraph or this stretch of dialogue and so forth? It can be a little bit frustrating to keep on bumping up against the strong and passionate feeling that these are people and that we want to talk about them that way instead.
What's the ratio of young men to women clamoring to get into your Jane Austen seminar?
It is very strongly weighted towards female students. Like I would say, if I get, let's say, 80 applications for 15 spots, there might only be 5 or 6 male students in the whole applicant pool.
And is it about love and romance and marriage or the wider screen of Austen's interests?
Well, I think in the class it ends up being the wider screen of Austen's interests, and I'm perfectly happy for it to be the love and romance strand of Austen that draws students in, and then maybe they get their minds blown when they really start thinking about some of the stuff that she pulls off with her writing.
So when you pivot them from that romantic strand that may bring them in, begin to introduce us to the rest of the kaleidoscope here.
Well, even working around the question of these relationships that are depicted in the novels, I do find that that can be a great starting point for thinking about some other stuff. I've got a couple passages. Would this be a good time to give them to you.
Well, I want to hear them most definitely, but we've got a break coming up, and I don't want you to run into it. So hold the passage. But on the romance front, what about marriage itself? You know, a great fixation, a certain kind of marriage, and others in her writing. How do, you know, student-age Americans today look at that depiction? What do you think about marriage today might bring them to it?
I think that's been a really important part of this last resurgence of interest in Austen, let's say, over the last 10 years or so. I think that in contemporary America, as from, let's say, the early 90s, marriage has sort of come front and center again as something, you know, it's a battleground in certain respects, but it's also holding a lot of cultural and ethical value for us right now. So I think that today's generation of college students are actually maybe thinking a lot more about marriage and about what kinds of marriage they might want to make and what that might say about themselves than, let's say, 15, 20 years ago, something like that.
We're talking this hour about Jane Austen mania again. There is something about Jane Austen that never goes away, and she's back bigger than ever right now. Becoming Jane, starring Anne Hathaway, opens nationally today. Claudia Johnson of Princeton University joins us. She's author of Jane Austen, Women in Politics, and the novel. Joins us from Princeton, New Jersey, and from New York. Jenny Davidson is here, professor of English at Columbia University, author of Hypocrisy and the Politics of Politeness, Manners and Morals, from Locke to Austen. Here from the 2005 film Pride and Prejudice, Keira Knightley as Lizzie Bennet resists marrying the wealthy Mr. Collins. Brenda Blethyn plays her mother, Donald Sutherland, her father, haggling over whether love or money takes precedence in the life of their daughter.
Tell her you insist upon them marrying.
Papa, please.
You will have this house.
I can't marry him.
And save your sisters from destitution.
I can't.
Go back now and say you've changed your mind.
No.
Think of your family.
You cannot make me.
Mr. Bennet, say something.
So, your mother insists on you marrying Mr. Collins.
Yes, well, she'll never see her again.
Well, Lizzie, from this day onward, you must be a stranger to one of your parents.
Who will maintain you when your father is dead?
Your mother will never see you again if you do not marry Mr. Collins, and I will never see you again if you do.
Mr. Bennet! Thank you, Papa.
From Hollywood's Pride and Prejudice, 2005, Claudia Johnson reminded us of just why marriage was so important and so fraught in Jane Austen's day.
Well, basically, if one did not have the good fortune of coming from a wealthy family, marriage was a woman's only possibility for comfort and subsistence, you know, in life. And women, more or less, only had one chance to get it right, so to speak. So, if a woman couldn't find a suitable and mutually respecting mate, she was more or less left on her own, destitute, or because there was no other alternative for subsistence.
We've got about a million Jane Austen fans who want in on this conversation. Let's go to Valerie in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Valerie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Okay. I wanted to talk about the cultural phenomenon of Jane Austen. I think with the movies and with the, I don't think you've talked about this yet, the sequels to her novels.
Right, lots of them written by just anybody who wanted to sort of jump on the train once she was gone.
Exactly. That is the irony, that Jane would probably deride all of this cultural phenomenon, bandwagon stuff. But at the same time, being an avid, avid Austen fan, I can't help from devouring them, going to see the movies, rewatching the tapes, seeing every available BBC adaptation, reading everything she wrote, reading as much as I can about what is written about her. I am a scholarly fan, but I am very much a bandwagon fan, too.
My little note here tells me that you've read Pride and Prejudice 50 times, 50. Yes.
It's ridiculous.
So in the book or on the screen, Valerie, is it the nuance, the subtle nuance of her dissection of relationships, or is it just all those bursting bodices?
not really, no. But it's the brilliance that she observes people with. It's absolutely amazing. We know all of these characters today. We've all run into a Darcy. We all think we're a Lizzie.
Look at you. Yeah, okay.
And we've all run into Mr. Collins, and we've all run into Lady Catherine, and we've all run into Isabel Thorpe, and we've run into them all. They're just as current and important today as they were 200 years ago.
That's terrific. Everybody wants to be a Lizzie. That is maybe the smartest one in the room who holds out for the real love and finally gets the guy. Let's take a call from Howard in Los Angeles. Hi, Howard. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, guest. It's a really exciting thing. I'm listening on XM Radio, and I just tuned in, and you guys are talking about my favorite writer
Great.
Of all time.
Why? What do you love?
Well, for instance, Persuasion, I think, is my favorite book by Austin, and that first passage where she describes the family, the Elliots. And she talks about how they have a register book that's a register of the families of England.
Right.
And it sits on a desk in a room. And when one unmarried Elliot walks by, she closes it. And when the father walks by, he opens it because he wants to see his name.
Right.
And it just in that one passage, you know these people and you know how they think. And the economy that she used in that is just brilliant.
And you go to the movies as well, Howard. You're in L.A., practically Hollywood's lap. Do they do it for you?
They do, as a matter of fact. The treatments have been, I think they're great. And again, it's that universality. It's that these people are, these characters are, they can be present day. You know, the whole middle class conundrum about money and marriage. And it's still with us today. These are universal truths that she talks to. That's why I think she maintains her popularity above all. And it just rings true.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And yet there's something about Jane, because how many other authors from 200 years ago do we read with any of that sense of absolute currency attached to them? Howard, thanks for calling from L.A. I want to bring another voice into our conversation, somebody who has seen the new movie that's opening today, Becoming Jane, and written really uproariously about the whole mania that's underway. Lev Grossman joins us. He's book editor at Time Magazine. Lev, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed your recent Time story. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
So you've got the thriving, throbbing industry of Jane Austen here, and no less than Colin Firth's Regency-era nipples in your text back on center stage. What's going on here, Lev?
Well, it is quite fascinating. And there is sort of a throb to it, in that sort of every 10 or 15 years, it seems like we get another surge of these productions. I don't think we've mentioned that the Masterpiece Theater is broadcasting the complete Jane Austen next year and refilming
right.
four of the novels, as well as doing their own biopic, which is following Becoming Jane, which is the Austen biopic that opens, I think, this weekend.
Yes, tell us about that. You've got Anne Hathaway, who of The Devil Wears Prada, James McAvoy of a bunch of things recently. Tell us about the film. What's the Jane that emerges in the biopic?
Well, it sort of worries away at this at what is, you know, the central biographical mystery of Austen, which is the fact that she never married. Which is just, I mean, you can't really separate, as little as we know about her life, you can't quite separate it from her work, because it adds a dimension of pathos to reading these books, which always end in a happy marriage, knowing that she herself, you know, never passed through to that promised land. She had one marriage proposal, I think, in her life, which she at first accepted, then turned down. So one has to wonder, what did she know of happy endings, since she didn't have one? And I think that's the question that the movie explores. And it does so really quite affectingly. One of the things that is ever present in Austen, which makes it, I think, so much more than just romance novels, is the economic difficulties, the ever-present threat of poverty that lurked behind all the women in her books. And Austen had to make, I'm sure, very difficult choices about marriage, and that's reflected in the book. And ultimately, you know, she ends up, of course, losing love and choosing art and sort of economic dependence. And it's a racking, wrenching choice, and it comes across very well in the movie.
Becoming Jane opens today nationally. Here's another little bit from the trailer: Anne Hathaway playing the young Jane Austen in an imagined story of one great failed love.
Your friend has no money, not a penny, and could not be expected to marry without it.
You could persuade her.
To sacrifice her happiness.
Affection is desirable. Money is absolutely indispensable.
You must know what I feel. I'm yours, heart and soul.
Run away with me.
What value will there be in life if we are not together?
Claudia Johnson, there's the fictionalized biopic with the one great love, the character Tom Lefroy, played by James McAvoy. But what does history tell us? What do we know about Jane Austen's love life?
Well, we don't know very much, although there certainly is a very vigorous interest in fantasizing about it or in thinking about it. We know that this was a mild, flirtation. We have no reason to believe that this was anything more intense.
But there actually was a Tom Lefroy. He had interactions with Jane. She wrote about them to her sister.
Yes, she did. She wrote about their flirtation, and she wrote about how nice looking he was. And we know that much later in life, long after Jane Austen had died, he mentioned having a flirtation with her. But we have no reason for believing that this had so decisive an impact on her career. And I might add that she she had drafted novels and written sketches from a very young age. So I think that Jane Austen was always a writer and was always very excited about being a writer. Do you know, the fact is that there was nothing terribly unusual about being unmarried. The unusual thing was to write all of these novels.
And what you do with it.
Exactly. And, it is my sense that that she derived a tremendous amount of pleasure and satisfaction from doing that.
Do you have a sense, either from her letters, from the record, or from her literature, of whether she even wanted to be married?
I think Jane Austen, as Jenny said, is somewhat of a mystery, and that too is a reason that she's continually attractive. To us. We do know that she really wanted to be a writer. We can't say for sure whether she really wanted to be married. I think she did realize that if she were married, she could not have been a writer.
Let's go to Therese in Providence, Rhode Island. Therese, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I recently saw the older edition of Pride and Prejudice, the film, the one with Colin Firth, and was struck. I'm not a reader of Jane Austen's works, but was very struck by how forthright the women were in their conversations with men. And I'm wondering if that is part of the way women really spoke at that time, or is that Jane Austen just being herself?
It's a great question. Jenny Davidson, what about the contemporaneity of this? I mean, is this Jane polishing the apple, making everybody look brilliant, subtle, nuanced, passionate, or do we have some sense that at that time in history it was an Austen world?
Well, I do think that Elizabeth Bennet is probably the heroine of Austen's with the widest appeal, right? She's the character we home in on when we think about this really attractively outspoken, free manners. But I find when I'm teaching Austen or when I'm teaching 18th century literature more generally, I do have to open my students' eyes sometimes to the fact that people did have sex outside of marriage in the 18th century. There didn't used to be some unbelievably repressive code of manners that was then only replaced in the 1960s with sexual license and freedom and outspokenness. So I think it's one of the fun things about reading Austen is that you do get these glimpses that somewhat call into question some of the ideas that we might have if we weren't thinking about it, about how people used to act.
Lev Grossman, how does Anne Hathaway play the intellect, passion of the loins ratio balance in Becoming Jane?
Well, she, as we all know, Anne Hathaway is a passionate being, and she... She does play this sort of slightly romantic capital R version of Austen, a young woman who's kicking against the constraints of a repressive society. Her plucky spirit can't be contained by the sort of the petty societal forces that try to keep her in her bodice. There's a lot of heavy breathing and whatnot. So, you know, there is that element, and I find it a little hard to believe that Austen, I tend to think of her as a little bit mousier than Anne Hathaway.
but then who isn't?
We're all a little mousier than Anne Hathaway.
Yeah, maybe so. Let's take a call from Mary in Hamden, Connecticut. Mary, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make a comment that I see Jane Austen as the mother of romantic comedy. And kind of what we call the forerunner of what we call in contemporary society of chick lit, it's referred to as, and that she kind of, I think one of the appeals of Jane Austen is that she continues to bring us in and kind of lead us into these stories that are as far away from our world as they are. They are still part of us, and the relationships and things about love and finding love. Having family relationships, having trouble with family, is still something that all of us is universal. That no matter what century it was written in, it is still universal. And it has, I think, Pride and Prejudice has one of the best opening lines of any novel, loosely quoted, because I don't have the novel in front of me right now. But that is it's a truth universally acknowledged that a young man of good fortune must be in want of a wife, and I think that is as modern as you can get. In terms of the dialogue between the sexes and between what women talk about and what men think.
Oh, Mary, you're right on it, and maybe many a hedge fund manager, if he still got his fortune this morning, sitting in that saddle, must be in want of a wife. Thanks for that. Claudia, what about Mary wants to give Jane credit for romantic comedy and for chick lit? I mean, here we are. We've had Bridget Jones and all the rest. How do you draw those threads back to Jane Austen?
Well, I think certainly since World War II, Austen has been seen primarily as a woman's writer. This wasn't the case, you know, in the 19th and early 20th century. But you can certainly see it in these recent waves of Jane mania. I might add that that whereas we tend to think that there might be a distinction between the smartness and the sexiness, I think what Austen does that's very attractive to women and to men is that she says that smartness is sexy.
Yeah.
And in fact, it is sexier than those cruder animal spirits that Elizabeth Bennet's sister exercises. She's the one who runs off and has sex without getting married.
Mm-hmm.
But it's Elizabeth whom everyone is really attracted to, the one who combines those two qualities of intellect and passion.
Jenny, the chick lit bridge, is Jane Austen the one standing at the other side of it, sort of who began to build it?
I think you could say that in some respects. I think of her novels having more in common, let's say, with those Hollywood comedies from the 1940s and 50s that are all about the ways that dialogue between a man and a woman can be a way of sort of negotiating a new settlement of some kind.
Right.
I thought that Bridget Jones was really a delightful novel, and the film adaptation very cleverly plays up the Austen connections.
We're talking about Jane Austen mania again. It's back. Becoming Jane, the fictionalized biopic of the early life of Jane Austen, opens nationally today, starring Anne Hathaway. Claudia Johnson is with us from Princeton University, Jenny Davidson from Columbia, and Lev Grossman from Time Magazine, the book editor there, author of Codex and Warp, the novel. Here's just a bit from that 1995 movie, Sense and Sensibility. Kate Winslet, as the fiery Marianne Dashwood, just learns a secret. Her sister, Eleanor Dashwood, played by Emma Thompson, has been hiding that Edward, who has fallen in love with Eleanor, is engaged to be married to another, Lucy.
Why did you not tell me?
Lucy told me in the strictest confidence. I could not break my word.
But Edward loves you.
He made me no promises. He tried to tell me about Lucy.
He cannot marry her.
Would you have him treat her even worse than Willoughby has treated you?
No. But nor would I have him marry where he does not love.
Edward made his promise a long time ago, long before he met me. Though he may harbour some regret, I believe that he will be happy in the knowledge that he did his duty and kept his word. After all, that is bewitching in the idea of one's happiness entirely depending on one person. It is not always possible, we must accept. Edward will marry Lucy, and you and I will go home.
Always resignation and acceptance. always prudence and honor and duty. Eleanor, where is your heart?
Sense and Sensibility, 1995, and the Byrds Twitter on there. Lev Grossman, you remind us, not everybody loved Jane Austen. I saw Mark Twain a bit caustic, and you quote Charlotte Bronte, queen of the romantic novel, saying, Austen, she ruffles her reader by nothing vehement, disturbs him by nothing profound. The passions are perfectly unknown to her. She rejects even a speaking acquaintance with that stormy sisterhood. Why does Hollywood love Jane Austen so much, Lev?
Well, one thing Austen does, she's obviously a great screenwriter. She pretty much invents the modern school of writing dialogue between men and women. If you look at any of her contemporaries, or predecessors, including Fielding, who she devours avidly, by the way, in the movie Becoming Jane.
Well, the suitor sort of turns her on to Tom Jones as a way to sort of sexualize the conversation.
Yes, that's right. I wouldn't try this at home, fellas, but he uses Tom Jones as a seduction.
Hey, baby, read this and come on up to my whatever.
As a seduction technique. But the fact is, Austen wrote much, much better dialogue than Fielding, and Fielding reads like a caveman compared to her. Austen has the power to do what nobody living in Hollywood can do today, which is open a romantic comedy. They pretty much don't get made anymore,
yeah.
Unless you can get Julia Roberts attached.
Right.
But Austen, she still plays in a way that nobody else does.
Jenny, what do you make of the way Hollywood, and for that matter the BBC, presents Austen? How does it line up with your scholar's internal image and tempo sound?
I must say something in me somewhat resists the very faithful adaptations. I think that my favorite Austen adaptation is Clueless because it really, imaginatively reconceives
Jane
whatever it was.
Jane goes to Beverly Hills, aristocracy
exactly.
There. Yep, yep.
There's something to me that is a little bit shuts things down about the feel of these kind of intense period dramas and so forth. There's such meticulous attention to costuming and settings and so forth that sometimes it seems to me to become a little bit less exciting than it is, less radical than the books really feel to me on paper.
Lev Grossman says she makes Fielding read like a caveman. You've got a reading or two there, Jenny. Can you share something with us? Tell us what you hear in it.
Yeah, I've actually got a couple short passages that are these moments of marriage proposals, and I like them and I use them with my students partly because they're actually quite different than the depictions of proposals that we get in the movie versions. Mm-hmm. For instance, even that proposal at the end of Pride and Prejudice that is something, that seems so perfect, Elizabeth Bennet has been such an outspoken heroine, and the way that Austen chooses to depict Elizabeth's response to that proposal, we literally don't even hear the words that she says. Austen writes that she immediately, though not very fluently, gave him to understand that her sentiments had undergone so material a change since the period to which he alluded as to make her receive with gratitude and pleasure his present assurances. It's such formal, conventional, bureaucratic language. We don't even really hear her voice speaking in the first person. It's not dialogue. It's a paraphrase of what she might have said. So I see Austen in these scenes subverting expectations to some extent. Let me just give you one more short passage from Emma in response to Mr. Knightley's proposal. Again, instead of Austen giving us what Emma actually says, the narrator simply observes, "She spoke then on being so entreated. What did she say? Just what she ought, of course. A lady always does."
Well, if she's lucky, if she's a lady written by Jane Austen. Oh, thanks. Let's take a call from Sherry in Canton, Massachusetts. Sherry, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to say I saw the movie last Friday night, and the theater was packed. It was all women, except for maybe five men.
Yeah.
And the scene I wanted to home in on that nobody's mentioned, there's a scene where she's meeting with a woman who's married and is a published novelist.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman, I don't recall her name, but she makes it very clear the angst that she goes through juggling her role as a wife and her success as a novelist.
Oh boy, she's speaking to every American woman right there. Okay.
Yes, and I thought your guests might want to comment on that, because that subject hasn't come up yet, that Jane already seemed to have a role model that she was aspiring to be like, And then she walks out of that scene realizing that she probably will not be able to do it because this woman is kind of making it clear that she isn't going to be able to succeed in both areas. And you get the feeling that the woman's marriage is suffering.
Hello, career woman, every woman these days. Let's try and parse out what's history and what's Hollywood there. First, Lev, just on that scene, did it strike you the same way, the sort of message to Jane Austen, you must choose?
Well, a little bit, yes. She's talking to Anne Radcliffe, the historically real Gothic novelist. And it's an interesting moment because the writing life, which was the life that Austen led, is one that she never wrote about in her books. She only wrote about the drama of romance and courtship. I don't think there are any writers in Austen, and the scholars will probably correct me on this. So, you know, to watch her make that choice, which is something that, you know, undoubtedly was a part of her life that she never told us about, was really quite touching. You know, it speaks to, again, something she didn't write about. The women who read Austen today are professionally and financially autonomous in a way that Austen could never be. I think it's an interestingly modern moment, and it does give us, I think, an authentic sense of perhaps what lay just outside the margins of Austen's books.
And what about the interplay between Anne Radcliffe and Jane Austen? Was it a role model or in reverse there somehow in history? Do we know? Or Claudia Johnson,
yeah,
I mean to ask? Sorry.
It's clear that Jane Austen never met Anne Radcliffe, although she certainly devoured her novels and loved all of her fiction. No, I think that was clearly something that was interpolated in order to, in the movie, in order to make certain things that we wonder about more explicit. You know, writing was not really considered a very genteel thing for a woman to do, particularly if she was from a family, as Austen was, that really had ambitions to climb up the social ladder. I think Austen, did have to make a choice, and I think she made it. But I don't think she had the benefit of the kinds of conversations attributed to her in the movie.
Events, her life was singularly barren. Her nephew, James Edward Austen Leigh, wrote later, "Few changes and no great crises ever broke the smooth current of its course." Claudia, you've got a bit of a longer reading there that I'd love to hear and get your sense of as well. I mean, the movies will have their days and their nights and their full theaters, but it's still those prose that we're really drawn back to. What have you got for us?
Okay, again, I have a passage from Northanger Abbey where the heroine feels, once again, very ignorant of intellectual trends. And the passage reads, "She was heartily ashamed of her ignorance, a misplaced shame. Where people wish to attach, they should always be ignorant. To come with a well-informed mind is to come with an inability of administering to the vanity of others, which a sensible person would always wish to avoid. A woman especially, if she had the misfortune of knowing anything, should conceal it as well as she can. The advantages of natural folly in a beautiful girl have already been set forth by the capital pen of a sister author, and that's Fanny Burney. And to her treatment of the subject, I will only add, in justice to men, that to the larger and more trifling part of the sex, imbecility in females is a great enhancement of their personal charms. There is a portion of them too reasonable and too well informed themselves to desire anything more in woman than ignorance." So this is a very interesting passage. Here we have this arch voice addressing us, and it feels like a privilege. But it's also a very a very difficult and in some ways grim passage, because knowledge here is characterized as a misfortune, particularly if it's a woman who has the knowledge. And what's so fascinating about this passage is actually saying the opposite of what we think it's going to say. We expect her to say that silly men like stupid women and sensitive sensible men like smart women. But actually, she says that silly men like stupid women and sensible men like ignorant women. In other words, the difference between the good guys and the bad guys starts to look pretty small. So there's this bright and sparkling quality of the prose, but it's tinged with a darkness. You know, it's never embittered. It's never, violent or passionate. But it's very knowing and rather... rather dark, and it's also very interesting in sort of deflating certain myths about romance, that it's a grand passion, when in fact sometimes people fall in love because they're flattered.
You've studied her for such a long time, Claudia. How have you come to picture, if not Anne Hathaway in Becoming Jane, how do you picture the Jane Austen sort of sitting, delving into all this subtlety of human interaction, the character, the demeanor? What's your mental image?
Well, that's a very good question, and I'm not really sure I can answer it, because Austen is so veiled, you know, that you do see her in little passages like these, you know, sort of disclose her bitterness or her skepticism, but it's very hard to imagine her personally. And I think, you know, Janeites often tend to think that they're Austen's friends. That's why they call her Jane and not Miss Austen. But I have to say, I only know her through her novels. It's very hard for me to get a sense of the person.
Jenny Davidson, Janeites, Claudia raises there. Some may be Janeites, some may not know what she's talking about. Janeites, it's kind of the blogger world and beyond of superfans.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Jane Austen has a huge afterlife online. There are lots of places that you can go and talk to, you know, far-flung correspondents who share your excitement about this person. It's certainly, if you think about it, I mean, we don't call Shakespeare Bill, and we don't call Dickens, you know, Charles, and so forth. This first name basis that avid readers of Austen feel themselves to be on is an unusual phenomenon. It goes back a long way.
Janeites and right off the web, but we've got Becoming Jane news roundup. So, I mean, if they're all over it, let's take a call from Kim in Marblehead, Massachusetts. Kim, you're on the air.
Tom, wonderful show. I wanted to ask your panel, having read the book numerous times, to me, I was curious what they thought. That to me, Elizabeth L. and certainly Colin Firth captured forever what Elizabeth and Darcy are all about. And although people like Keira Knightley, of course, are gorgeous, I couldn't relate to them the same. To me, Elizabeth L. will forever be Lizzie, and Colin Firth will forever be Darcy. I was curious what your experts thought.
Well, let's see. BBC versus Hollywood in depiction, Elizabeth L. versus Keira Knightley. Claudia, Jenny, Lev, who's got an opinion?
Well, I have to say that I was brought up on the 1940s version of this novel, and while I don't think that Greer Garson is an ideal Elizabeth, I did think that Olivier was an ideal Darcy, and so it's his image that is rather fixed in my mind as someone both vulnerable and edgy and proud.
Jenny, preferences here for depictions?
I think the main thing I'd say is that TV really has an edge over film for representing these novels, in that the kind of expansiveness that you get over a sort of multi-part television adaptation, so I guess I'd frame it not so much in terms of the actors as that the depth of the knowledge of character that you can get in television is just a better fit with the novel form.
And Lev Grossman, where do we go now? I mean, every novel has been mined and now will be mined again. The BBC coming back for a second pass at everything, all kinds of sequels written, and we've got Clueless and Bridget Jones and all the rest, now even making up stories about Jane's life in order to keep something on the screen. I mean, do you ever tap this out?
This seems to be one of these wonderfully renewable resources that it doesn't seem as if we ever can really get to the bottom of Jane Austen. There's no limit to the number of times we can go around again. No limit to that she's infinitely rereadable. I think that this wonderful is one of those wonderful and miraculous and rather inexplicable things about Austen, that she is inexhaustible.
Well, when it comes to her, we'll quote the lady herself, and I'm not even sure the source of this. I just found a quote floating, "Why not seize the pleasure at once? How often is happiness destroyed by preparation? Foolish preparations. We'll just get out and read and see and enjoy it up one side and down the other." Lev Grossman, thanks for your humorous, thriving, throbbing write-up of the whole mania. We really appreciate it. Thanks for being with us today.
You're quite welcome.
Lev Grossman, book editor at Time Magazine. And Jenny and Claudia, it's been wonderful to have you. Jenny Davidson, professor of English at Columbia University. Good luck filling, winnowing those applicants down to 15 slots for your seminar this fall. Thanks for joining
us.
And Claudia Johnson at Princeton University, author of Jane Austen, Women in Politics, and the novel. Thank you so much for being here.
What a pleasure. Thank you.
On Point is produced by Chris Burrell, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hilary McQuilkin, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.